Betrayal doesn't have to be the end of your story. Roxana Johnson joins us to share how women can turn the pain of a partner's sexual addiction into a journey of healing, boundaries, and self-discovery.
Welcome to Women Winning Divorce, the podcast helping successful women navigate divorce with dignity so you can protect yourself, your children, and your assets. I'm Heather Quick, founding attorney at Florida Women's Law Group, where women win at life.
This week, we had Roxana Johnson on the show, and we had a great conversation about sexual addiction, betrayal, and healing. She shared her personal story, insights on forgiveness and boundaries, and practical tools for women to reclaim their lives. Welcome to this week's episode of Women Winning Divorce. I'm Heather Quick, owner and attorney at Florida Women's Law Group. Today, Roxana Johnson is joining us. Roxana is the author of Forgotten in the Battle with Sexual Addiction, The Journey of a Spouse. Her work is dedicated to helping spouses of sex addicts who often feel tremendous shame, isolation, betrayal trauma, and even PTSD find hope and healing. Today, Roxana and I will be discussing how sexual addiction impacts marriages and families, recognizing the signs of addiction in yourself or a partner, and tools for healing, forgiveness, and setting boundaries. Welcome, Roxana.
Thank you, Heather. Thank you for bringing me on. This is quite a privilege.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I'm looking forward to this conversation. I know it will be so beneficial for our listeners and, you know, we'll also learn so much. So for our listeners, Roxana, would you share a little bit about yourself and, you know, how you got to be where you are today and this book?
I sure will. I have lived with people who had addictions since the beginning of my life. First as a child, my father was an alcoholic, and as a sibling and as a spouse of multiple marriages. And I was married to Jack for 24 years when his addiction became apparent, should I say. Okay. And I had done some healing before that, but it was at that point that I had to put purpose and meaning and be deliberate about my healing. Mm-hmm. There wasn't services available or resources during that time because that was over 15 years ago. And especially for sexual addiction, it wasn't even a valid term in those days. Mm-hmm. And so we made a lot of mistakes. There were a lot of potholes in the journey, but a seed began to be planted because I thought, what if my mistakes could help somebody else in this journey? Right. I knew that this would become an even more prevalent problem. And I thought, what if I could help someone avoid some of those potholes? And also help the people who support the spouses, the clergy, family, you know, people like that. And I'm a writer by profession. And so all that merged and produced this book.
Awesome. So happy that you were able to get this book out and I can't wait to talk about it. How did you first become familiar with the concept of sexual addiction?
Well, you know, that's an interesting story because I was married for 24 years, Heather. And I had no idea that Jack was using lust and masturbating every single day. He kept it so secretive, which is one of the characteristics of addiction, and especially this addiction. And I became very ill. Jack thought I was going to die. And that took his behaviors, because addiction is progressive in nature. He started acting out physically. And so at the end of this 7-month serious illness, he sat me down and gave me a very sterile confession, one that I really didn't even understand, if you want to know the truth. Yeah. He promised that nothing else would ever happen. No, he talked about strip clubs and phone sex and just the lusting and masturbating. He promised that nothing else would ever happen. I told him that we would try and get through it, and then I went into shock. About a week later, because of my history and understanding, at least intuitively, that addiction has cycles, I started to recognize that Jack was again going through a cycle. Okay. And the spirit said, check his wallet, which I did, which I had no reason to do before this. And I found motel receipts. The next morning, I asked a coworker to cover for me at work. I went to the bank, and what I found horrified me, sickened me. Mm-hmm. And I asked Jack to meet me at a park. And I said, if you don't find some help, because I don't know who you are or what you're doing, but if you don't get some help, I'll divorce you. And to his credit, because he was totally out of control, he checked himself into an inpatient substance abuse facility. Now, you have to understand that we both thought that it was maybe substance abuse, because that's what we were both familiar with.
Understand.
Sometime during this inpatient program, the resident counselor sat me down and said, I think your husband is a sex addict. And I responded with, what is that?
Mm-hmm.
And that was my first awareness that that term even existed. And I dug in from there.
Now, for our listeners who may not know, how do you define addiction in general and then sexual addiction specifically?
So to me, Heather, addiction is very simply the inability to, or the unwillingness to handle intense emotion. Now, that can be good or bad emotions, and they run to their substance or their behaviors to soothe themselves or to regulate themselves. Okay.
Okay.
The American Society of Addictive Medicine talks about all sorts of things like a brain disease, circuitry, the neurotransmitters. It also mentions predispositions and you know, happenings in our life contributing to addiction. But the driving force is dopamine, okay? The drug of choice produces extreme levels of dopamine in the body, and that's what gives the addict their high or regulates them. Okay. So that's addiction in general. Okay. With sexual addiction, most experts will list the following as concerns: that the person fantasizes about sexual acts on a regular basis and then performs those fantasies or works to perform them. They're leading a double life, you know, affairs and so forth. The other things is that they're masturbating once or more times a day. It becomes compulsive, okay? The other thing is that they spend a lot of time planning and then executing several sexual acts, okay? But this addiction, as with any addiction, is progressive in nature. So then it will go to using sex services, having multiple partners, having multiple affairs. From there, it will often go to bringing in substance abuse and even harm to themselves and the partner. And then it gets really scary because then it gets psychological in nature.
Got it. Now, you know, when you realize your spouse was struggling with a sexual addiction, you didn't, I'm sure, and I know this from your book, you didn't trust anyone. And I'd love for you to, you know, unpack that for our listeners. Tell us, like, really what was going on with you when you found this out.
Okay. First, I'll give you a little bit of information. And then more of what it did to me. But betrayal trauma is the term they've attached to sexual addiction to the spouse. Okay, and simply what that is in a relationship where you need to trust the other person, they break that trust at a foundational level. That can include abuse, can include cheating and lying. It can include financial deception, sexual addiction. There's all of those factors involved, okay? Right. And so betrayal trauma has, as some of its characteristics, the spouse isolate. I isolated, even though I was a social person, because you become ashamed. You're hypervigilant. And that's the part that makes you so you don't trust anyone. And if you think about it, Heather, the person or one of the people you need to trust at a foundational level has completely broken that trust. You do not understand who they are. And so as a result, because I was so duped, I didn't trust myself. And because of the usually there's an explosion in the life, in the relationship before this comes out, okay? And so if you're a person of faith, you don't trust your God either. Because you've gone into fight or flight at the most fundamental level. And so I'll tell you how I felt, Heather, is it felt like my heart was breaking anyway. And it felt like if someone else delivered another blow, I might die. You know, and that makes it so you don't trust anyone. And most of the people around you don't know what to think because they've thought you were an okay couple. And there's all sorts of blaming going around. So yeah, it's very natural and normal. Every person I saw walk through those 12-step meeting doors had some level of distrust in their heart and their eyes.
Now, how can someone discover if their partner or maybe even they are struggling with a sexual addiction?
You know, the first thing that I would look for is secrecy. Do they hide things? Are you hiding things? The other thing is compulsion, okay? If sex is a normal part of life, that's what makes this addiction so complex, is this is a normal part of life. Right. But if it becomes overemphasized, if it's not in proper context of the relationship, the day, the person, that's an issue. If you do it against your values, that's an issue. And if it's getting worse, that's the other thing, is addiction is progressive in nature. Mm-hmm. So if one thing met your needs before and you're having to escalate the drug, so to speak, then there might be something to worry about.
Yeah, I get it. Now, does sexual addiction often appear like another type of mental health challenge at first?
Absolutely. I thought before Jack came to me with this sterile disclosure, I had noticed changes. I thought maybe he was bipolar because he was so unpredictable and he could change personalities in a second. And this was all new. And so what I would say is if someone suspects that their partner or spouse has addiction, specifically this addiction, that they watch for changes like unpredictability. Cruelty, if the spouse has not been cruel before and suddenly becomes very cruel and very selfish. Another thing is objectifying, which means that you are just an object to the spouse. Okay, that's one of the reasons why sexual addiction is so painful. It's because you take the most intimate act of sex and you turn it into a transaction, demanding. Does your partner demand all the time, attention, and finances in the family, in the relationship? All these things are factors that most people's intuition is like something's wrong, okay? Yeah. The other part of this is if you come to them and say, hey, this is how you're behaving, and you ask them to get help, and they respond with, nope, I refuse, that's a flag. That's a problem. Also, if they respond, if you notice sexual behaviors that are inappropriate, flirting even, and they say, don't you trust me? That's a flag.
Yeah. And I mean, it's because it is an addiction. And so I would presume, right? I mean, it might show up in a different way than, you know, a substance abuse but it's still behavior of an addict.
Yes.
Correct. And they can be very manipulative and like you said, very deceptive and, you know, keeping things secret.
Lies are part of addiction and minimizing what they're doing or outright denial that what they're doing is wrong is also part of it.
Now, Do you think your spouse's addiction had any connection to his LDS church background?
You know, I love that question, Heather. And that's a tricky question.
I believe it.
I'll tell you why, okay? So prevalence in pornography use is the only demographic for that I've ever heard used or that I have used in my own research about what populations are affected by this. Okay. And there are more pornography subscriptions in zip codes that have higher than average income, that have higher than average social capital, meaning they volunteer, they're part of their community, they engage, they do good things.
Right. Okay?
And higher ratio of higher education. Okay. Those are three of the characteristics. There's a fourth one. Young age, 15 okay. to 24. But that's kind of understandable for pornography viewing.
Young age. Okay. Yeah.
But those three other characteristics are typical of a successful person. And often successful people are also religious. And that's why I think sexual addiction is also very easy to hide at first.
Mm-hmm.
And I think all those components come together to make it that, yes, there is a lot of sexual addiction in religious communities. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it's, I don't think that that's a causation. I think it's a correlation.
Okay.
Because I think it is a good addiction for those prone to addiction when people are successful.
Now, I do find that interesting, but I don't have a follow-up question, but I really appreciate your answer because I think that's helpful for people to understand that there may be a correlation and you may see those common commonalities, just not causation. Now, spouses often face shame, isolation, betrayal, trauma, and even PTSD. Can you share what that was like for you, for our listeners?
Yeah. In fact, that would be really good for your listeners. It was one of the most painful parts of my life. Noises bothered me. I couldn't even tolerate the happy noises of my grandchildren playing. I couldn't remember names. I couldn't remember a lot of things. And I couldn't articulate my ideas, even in a professional setting. And I found out later that trauma affects the speech area of the brain. I was very high strung. I describe it as feeling like I was wound tighter than a rubber band. I was anxious and I just wasn't myself. I had my first ever panic attacks in meetings I had attended for years. And all that translates into that the people around you don't know how to take you either. And so it becomes more isolating. There's also the factor that this is a secretive thing that happens to couples at first. And so people were watching me thinking, wow, you are really high strung. And accepting his blame of me, that our marriage was in trouble because of me. You know, it's just, you know, it just feels like your life is breaking. And given all that heavy information, I want your listeners to know that that does not describe me now. It did right. not describe me a year and a half, 2 years later. And there is hope. And there is help for betrayal trauma.
And that's great. That's good positive news for sure. Now, in your book, you talk about forgiveness. Forgiveness means that your treatment of someone is not based on past occurrences. You treat them as the person they are today. Could you unpack that for us?
I can. You know, forgiveness, I have a whole chapter on forgiveness because forgiveness is tough. Okay.
Yeah.
And to me, I'm a person of faith. So to me, forgiveness is a gift that I get from my higher power or God after I've done the legwork.
Right.
But part of that legwork is you have to be willing to let go of the pain. Mm-hmm. I held on to the pain and was angry for over a year after disclosure because somehow I felt that that pain would validate what had happened to me. Okay. And also there's another component. Most spouses of addicts become, as one of their coping mechanisms, they become fixers. Okay. They become over responsible for everyone else and to keep everything peaceful as much as they can, okay?
Okay.
And so what forgiveness does is it allows you to let go of that pain and the outcome. And so you're no longer playing mind games with yourself about the past. You're able to live in the future, in the present, I mean, and you're able to make decisions based on who you are and who the other person is in the present. And what that means to me, well, first let me tell you, you know, there was a saying that circulated in our groups that brought me physical relief. And it said, even God can't change the past. Now, Heather, I don't know if he can't change the past or if he won't change the past. But what that said to me was that if God could just move forward, then so could I. And to do that, I had to let go of my past. Okay. So what that means on forgiveness is when you forgive somebody, you let go of that past and you let go of the outcomes and the justice and the retribution of that past. And it frees you. It gives you power over the now. And so if you're still dealing with a spouse or a partner who's still a cheat and a liar, you can be civil and cordial because you're dealing with yourself in the now and you know you're not going to let them hurt you anymore. And you know they're not trustable. But if you're dealing with a repentant spouse or partner, then you can also look at the situation with clarity and decide whether you are willing to do and them, whether you're both willing to do the very hard work of rebuilding trust. And that's what it means to me to forgive and let go.
How long did it take you to be able to do that?
It took me 5 years.
Okay. Okay. I think that's awesome. That, I mean, because it's, you're not saying, I think sometimes, you know, we're like, oh, that's not easy. It's not, but it's worth it.
Right.
It's a gift for yourself.
Yes.
Right.
It is. Right. And the other thing is at the beginning, I thought that forgiving somehow meant that it was okay. It's never okay. It's never, ever okay. But it just means you're not in charge of the justice system.
Right. Right. Now, and how does that affect you today? Because the two of you share children, right? Grandchildren?
Yes. And I lost Jack to heart disease about 7 years ago. But I have since tried another marriage and there was some more addiction. So, Heather, what it does for me today,
yes,
I continue to work really hard at living in forgiveness so that I can be happy and at peace today.
That's awesome. That's really good. I love hearing that. Now, you also emphasize the importance of community support and betrayal trauma groups. Now, and I'd love to understand how that, you know, is helpful and different from maybe traditional therapy that might not be enough.
Okay.
If you could.
That's an excellent question. Okay. That's a question I get asked regularly. And first, I want to say to your listeners, please choose a therapist who understands betrayal trauma because it is very complex. Okay. Second, you're learning some really abstract concepts at a time when your brain has been hijacked by fear and distrust. Okay. And other things. And it was in the 12-step meetings and in conversations with other women who had gone through similar things that were working toward living peacefully, living in recovery, that I was able to see those abstract principles being lived. And so I learned application in those situations. I learned what that abstract concept might look like in my own life. The other help that the community gives, that type of community, is recovery from this is not linear. Okay. And so there's going to be crazy thinking along the way. If you are trying to work recovery with that addicted spouse, there's going to be relapses. And what it does is it gives you, that community gives you a net of people that you can contact, you can call, you can text. And just those tactile activities allows your frontal lobe to reconnect when you're in those crazy making places, and it allows you to breathe and then think clearly and make deliberate decisions. So to me, those are the two main reasons that I chose to also be part of a 12-step community.
And I can see the benefit. You know, like you said, when you can see other people living that, it can validate those steps for you.
And explain them.
Yeah, right. Now, boundaries are essential. I would love it if you could explain your if-then formula and how it differs from ultimatums.
Okay. And first I'll talk about the ultimatum.
Okay.
Boundaries in general, the difference between a boundary and an ultimatum is that ultimatums are all about controlling the other person. Okay. The intention is to control the other person. Boundaries are about my emotional, psychological, and physical safety. Okay. Mm-hmm. So it's intention. Okay. Boundaries give us space. Okay. Right. Space to ground ourselves and to make deliberate decisions. So for instance, one of my boundaries was if Jack is flirting and the consequence or the solution to me going into crazy thinking was for me to leave the situation, it gave me space. It gave me time and space to connect with my own self, to connect with God, and then to decide how best to respond, okay? And usually that meant that we would have a discussion later on, but I was serious about this. I put tennis shoes in my trunk of my car because we went to family things a lot that were way far away, and he would even flirt there. I have left an ICU room before. I've left him there. Yeah. And these were all good things because these boundaries allowed me to center myself, and then mm-hmm. I wasn't crazy.
Got
One
it.
Huge boundary, boundaries can also become bottom lines, Heather. And that's when you are in recovery, you've thought very deliberately, and you've decided that a specific action will result in ending the relationship. Now, the perpetrator's going to say that that's an ultimatum, but it wasn't in my case, okay?
Okay?
So because recovery is not linear, we had had several very serious relapses. And I think it was on relapse number 2 or 3, and these are serious ones,
okay?
And I took some time, and I decided that if Jack wasn't serious enough about his own recovery to stop these very substantial relapses, mm-hmm. then I was prepared to end the marriage. And so my boundary was I told him, I said, I am filling out divorce papers. When I'm in a good place, I have the emotional bandwidth to find a good attorney. I have the emotional bandwidth to do the paperwork. And I said, I don't want to file this divorce. But I will if there's another one of these serious relapses. You know, he took that as an ultimatum, Heather. He told a medical provider he was suicidal, and that put him in a psych ward for 5 days. It was horrible. But mm-hmm. I knew in my heart that the reason why I had the boundary was for my benefit. And as an epilogue, he said it was a deterrent to another serious relapse a couple of years later. So that's the difference, Heather, is boundaries mm-hmm. are about ourselves, not about them.
Right. You know, I think so. You guys stayed married until he died?
We had about 8 years of recovery.
8 years of recovery. And I, you know, think that you could be so helpful. I know this is helpful to most women because, you know, many women might say, forget it. I'm out. Mm-hmm. I am not going to go down this recovery road with you. How did you make that decision?
Well,
do it with him?
Heather, that was his decision. I was going to do recovery regardless.
Okay.
Because that was for my emotional health. And that's the other thing. Is there isn't not a healthy, respectful relationship that does not have boundaries. And right. So even if you stay in the relationship and they do the Herculean effort needed to recover, you're going to need boundaries. Even if they leave in this last marriage, I have still had to have boundaries right. because they're about keeping me mentally, emotionally, and physically safe.
Right. So you said, I'm doing recovery, but also I mean, how did you decide to stay married, though? Because, like, some people be like, you can do your recovery, I'll do my recovery, but we're not going to stay married.
You know, Heather, that was a spiritual decision for me. And I felt like my higher power was telling me to give it time. And I had a very wise counselor by this point, and I gave it a year. Okay. Because I wasn't going to stay if there wasn't complete fidelity. I was not going to stay. The other thing is finding recovery raised the bar for marriage for me. I was not going to be content in a mediocre marriage. I wanted an intimate marriage. Mm-hmm. And therefore, in my mind, I was giving him time to decide what he wanted for his life.
Okay.
And at the same time, I was moving forward in my own. As an epilogue, he, at the end of that year, things were better, but they weren't good enough, Heather.
Okay.
And I gave it another 6 months. And in that 6 months, you know, my soul knew. In that 6 months, he came out with a deception that he had kept.
Mm.
It taught him about honesty, about total honesty. And from that point on, our marriage blossomed. But you have to have total honesty, especially in these relationships.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, how I know you can answer it somehow. I'm not sure how, but I'm going to ask you, how will a spouse know if their partner is truly choosing recovery and healing, right? Because they've been through so much betrayal.
Right.
And all these things you've talked about and like doubting yourself and is he really doing it or not? Am I getting sucked in to a whole lie again? Like how can you help, you know, our listeners feel like ways to know?
Okay. So there's two components to this. Okay. First of all, by working recovery, you reconnect with yourself. And no matter what you call it, whether you call it help from your higher power or your intuition or anything, you begin to trust yourself again. And you almost get a sixth sense about when your spouse is in a good place and when they're not in a good place. And therefore, you can protect yourself from them, even if you're giving the marriage a chance, okay? The other part of it is you will begin to see glimpses of your spouse being humble, honest, and accountable. Now, I say glimpses because it takes the addict brain time to recover, okay? And so what you're hoping for, most of us can't be on our best behavior all the time, okay? Right. Especially an addict. But what you're hoping for is to see those glimpses get longer and longer, okay?
Okay.
The other thing that you will see in the addict is they will begin to see you as a person, not as an object. You become a real life person with wants and hopes and dreams and hurts that deserve to be respected, acknowledged, and talked about. Okay. And again, you'll see glimpses and then longer and longer.
So you better be patient, right?
My goodness. And patient is not one of my strong points. So yes, Heather, I had to work. I had to work at that a lot.
I'm sure. Well, and that's good, right? Because that's, we're just trying to, you know, be honest. And I appreciate that because the way you explain that with glimpses and that'll help our listeners, right? Like, okay, well, I don't want them to overexpect, right? Like, so they expect like, it's all going to change the next day.
Right.
Which is unrealistic, but and just probably just not even possible, right? That just doesn't happen. Like you said, the brain takes time.
It takes months to dry out and then to start to think clearly. Yes.
Now, for women listening who may be in the midst of this struggle, what is one thing they can do today to begin healing and reclaiming their power?
I loved this question too, but I have a really difficult answer.
Okay.
Okay. The first thing that I would encourage them to do is every single day look in the mirror and say, I'm beautiful. I'm good. I'm important. And mm-hmm. I'm willing, or I'm worth the work it will take to heal. Yeah. You know, when I started, I couldn't look at the mirror and say that. My eyes were down. Look at the mirror until you can look yourself in the eye and say that every day. And then as a part of that, you need to seek support and help from a competent therapist. And hopefully you can find a good recovery-based 12-step program. And what I mean by that is they're not sitting in their pain and just swirling in it. They're saying, this is where I am. And this is the situation, and this is the tool I'm going to try and use today to get through the day and create some peace and happiness in my life.
That's great advice. I appreciate that. Now, Roxana, before we go, because our show is Women Winning Divorce, what does winning at life mean to you?
You know, Heather, because of all this experience with addiction, my thoughts are complex and yet simple. Winning at life means I have peace about my life. It means that I know that in difficult situations, I can pause and I can connect with my own self and then make the next right decision. And those right decisions can be for this year, for this day, or even for this moment. And to me, that gives me freedom and it gives me hope for a lot of happiness in my future.
Thank you. That's beautiful. We've reached the end of our show, and I am so thankful to you, Roxana Johnson, for joining us to discuss your experience and expertise on sexual addiction, betrayal, trauma, and recovery.
Thanks, Heather. It has been really enjoyable to visit with you about this, and I hope that it's helpful for some of your listeners.
Well, I know it will be. Lastly, where can our listeners find you for more information and resources?
I have a website for the book, and it's the full title, Forgotten in the Battle with Sexual Addiction, The Journey of a Spouse.com. I also, my Instagram page is Forgotten Spouse, and it has a link tree on it, which has all my social media and how to buy the book.
Well, wonderful. And we'll make sure that those are, of course, in the show notes. I'm so thankful for your time today and sharing your story. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Heather.
Listeners, if you or someone you know in the Northeast Florida area is going through or even thinking about divorce, you're not alone. Taking that first step can feel overwhelming, but it doesn't have to be. Our newsletter is filled with actionable advice tailored to guide you through this process. By signing up, you'll gain the tools to face the unknown with courage and see if we're the right fit to support you during this life-changing time. Don't wait. Click the link in the show notes, fill out the form, and take the first step toward building a brighter future today.
This podcast is for informational and entertainment purposes only and is not an advertisement for legal services. The information provided on this podcast is not intended to be legal advice. If you have a legal issue, please contact an attorney in your local jurisdiction. The views and opinions expressed by the hosts and guests are solely those of the individuals and do not represent the views or opinions of the firms or organizations with which they are affiliated. This podcast is available for private, non-commercial use only. Any editing, reproduction, or redistribution of this podcast for commercial use or monetary gain without the expressed written consent of the podcast's creator is prohibited.